Welcome to the Science Podcast for December 21st, 2007. I'm Robert Frederick. This week, a special podcast on the major science stories of the year to go along with a breakthrough of the year news section in this week's magazine. All this, plus some favorite stories of the year from our free online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the Science Society, publishers of Science Magazine, advancing science and technology for the benefit of all people. The American Association for the Advancement of Science at www.aaas.org.
Each year, Science Magazine publishes a special news section describing the journal's choice for the breakthrough of the year, plus nine runners-up. Joining me to talk about this year's top 10 choices is Science's Deputy Editor for Life Sciences, Katrina Kellner, and Deputy News Editor for Physical Sciences, Robert Kuntz. Welcome. The first thing I've got to ask is, how do you choose the breakthrough and runners-up for the year? Katrina?
Well, I mean, the way we do it is we, in fact, all get into a room and spend an hour or two going through all the ideas and hashing out all the details, and we end up with a list that then gets culled down further. So there's a lot of really lively discussion about it, with people having favorites and arguing for and against certain candidates. It's a fun process, actually.
Okay, so there are 10 of these, but this isn't a top 10 list, is it, Robert?
No, we're not really rank ordering these. We have 10 because 10 is the traditional number, but it's not that we're saying that number 3 is better than number 7 or anything like that. It's just the number that we happen to have. We have one big breakthrough, we have nine runners-up, and that's what you get.
Well, then let's start with one that perhaps everyone can relate to, checkers.
And the breakthrough this year is that checkers is dead. There's no point in playing it against a computer anymore because a properly programmed computer will always win.
We all know that computers can play checkers, but in terms of understanding how it works out mathematically, the computational power had never been there. It takes an awful lot of computer time to work through an entire game of checkers.
They couldn't just crank through the game from beginning to end because there were just too many positions. 500 billion different positions in checkers. That's 5 times 10 to the 20th. And even a really super computer can't do that yet. So they had to be a little clever about it.
So the advance that was made for this study was a computational one. They figured out that you only had to look at the end game and the beginning game and assume that the contestants played perfectly in between. And by doing that, it short-circuits the computational difficulties and allows the computational analysis to be done in a reasonable amount of time. And when they did that analysis, they found that, in fact, if both contestants play perfectly, checkers always results in a draw.
The checkers, like tic-tac-toe, is now a dull game.
So there's no way for a human to win anymore? Because a human wouldn't be able to be a perfect player?
If you play perfectly, it'll be a draw. But being human, you're bound to make a mistake sooner or later, and then you're toast.
Okay. This next one is titled Back to the Future.
That's right. And the breakthrough in this case comes from a series of studies that show that your ability to remember the past is connected to your ability to imagine the future. So memory and imagination are linked.
So this breakthrough involves a part of the brain that we know a lot about. It's part called the hippocampus. It's an ancient part of the brain. We know it has a lot to do with memory. If your hippocampus is damaged, whether you're a rat or a person, you can't remember things very well.
Researchers found this out in a couple of different ways. First of all, one team in the United Kingdom studied 5 people with a special kind of amnesia, and they found out that these people not only had trouble remembering the past, but when you asked them to imagine doing something in the future, like going to the beach or something, it was really hazy and vague, just the same way their memories are. Now, other results managed to confirm this link through brain scanning. A different group actually looked at people who were remembering the past and imagining the future and found out that the same parts of their brains lit up. And then another group still did the same sort of experiment, only that they did it with rats in a maze.
And even rats, as they're trying to think about going forward in a maze towards a food reward, can't do this properly if they don't have an intact hippocampus. So this is an important part of the brain. We're excited to learn more about it, but I think most importantly, it gives us a window into tasks that we might think of as uniquely human, like imagination, creativity, and show they have a biological substrate just like our physiological functions, like keeping your heart going.
It's a really intriguing result.
Well, then from people and rats with damaged hippocampuses, it seems fitting that our next story is titled Doing More with Less.
This breakthrough really got our chemists excited.
Why?
So synthetic chemists over the years have had to use fairly tedious, time-consuming methods to synthesize new complicated molecules. They have to put protective groups on parts of their reagents that they don't want modified. They have to use tricks to try to activate the parts that they want to react with another reagent. In the last year, there has been some really clever chemistry going on that moves us beyond that era.
And the details are really complicated, and they have to do with turning molecules called amines into molecules called amides, and a lot of other things like that. But the technique is really ingenious and has a lot of promise.
So I imagine that this will be important to pharmaceutical companies.
Yes, drugs, for example, are going to benefit a lot from this.
What's the next breakthrough?
So this one, which we call Divide to Conquer, has to do with T cells, which are part of the immune system that attacks invaders, pathogens. You've heard a lot about T cells in treatments for AIDS, for example. This is kind of a T cell called a CD8 T cell. And it turns out that normally this kind of T cell just sort of sits there until another cell called a dendritic cell brings it a sample of one of these invaders. And then the T cell starts to split and make more T cells to go and attack the invader.
It needs to make a daughter to go out and fight the attack. And it needs to make a memory cell that will remember that pathogen in case of a future infection. And immunologists have figured out how the cell does this. When it encounters the pathogen, the portion of the immune cell that actually touches the pathogen as presented by another immune cell becomes the memory cell, and the one furthest away from the pathogen goes off into the blood to fight infection.
So it's a function by proximity.
That's right.
Exactly.
How did they make this discovery?
Researchers caught some that had just divided.
So the breakthrough is that they figured out how memory cells and functional T cells are formed.
Okay. Now to the breakthrough titled Electrons Take a New Spin. Robert?
This is something that nobody but a physicist could really understand. But the general idea is that you take an electron, and everybody knows that an electron has charge, and that an electrical current is the movement of charges through a material. Well, it turns out that electrons have other properties too, and one of them is called spin. It's as if the electrons are spinning like a top. They're not really spinning like a top. They're not really there in the same sense that a top is, but they do have this property.
It's a nice metaphor.
It's a metaphor. Okay, researchers have been trying for a long time to make these spins behave in a way that they can control and use them to make, not electronic devices, but spintronic devices. The idea is that you'll be able to have a whole new kind of gadget that's based on this different property. And this year, researchers took a step in that direction by demonstrating something that had been theoretically predicted, which is called the quantum spin Hall effect. And the idea is that if you take a thin slab of material, very thin, a wafer of material, you run electrons through it in a current, and then you zap it with an electric field going at right angles, the electrons will behave in a strange way. You'll get a spin current along the edge of the material that flows without any resistance. Now, you can do the same sort of thing with electrons and charge, but you have to do it with magnetic fields and very, very powerful ones, and at extremely low temperatures. You have to get it down near absolute zero. The advantage of the quantum spin Hall effect is you do it with electrical fields, and there's a chance that you might be able to do it warmer. So it was a theoretical prediction. It panned out, and it might have the potential to make a new kind of spintronic device.
So even though everybody's excited about these so-called spintronic effects, this is just the first step, and it will take a long, long road of technological development to bring it to fruition and make new computers. But it's very exciting to see this first critical step in spintronics.
Well, from spintronics to the next breakthrough, called Beyond Silicon. It sounds like there's a computer theme going on here.
Yes, these are both in the area of physics called condensed matter physics, or solid state physics, which means solid stuff, as opposed to gases and liquids. And that's where all the semiconductors are and all the things that go into all of your gadgets, your iPhones and your iPods and your whatever you got. All those devices are based on silicon chips. But researchers hope that they can go beyond silicon because someday they're going to run out of new chips. They're going to push silicon to its limits. So they're already looking for new materials. And one of them that they're looking at are these crystal structures called transition metal oxides, which are metals with oxygen in them.
The principle is that metal oxides, when made into a sandwich with smoothly finished surfaces, exhibit very interesting properties right at the interface between the two metal oxides. That interface shows properties of semiconductors. They can be superconductors. But the best thing is that by controlling the exact characteristics of the metal oxides, you can actually tailor the semiconductor's properties, and you can synthesize these semiconductors to have the properties that you need for your application.
So what will these new metal oxides really be able to do?
So they think that they might be able to make combinations of these oxides that can perform better than semiconductors do, and that will be the next big thing when silicon finally starts to fail us.
I think our whole physical science group in the editorial office agreed that these materials are critical and that this definitely made the list for Breakthrough of the Year this year.
And for anyone who wanted a smaller, faster, lighter computer, too.
Indeed.
Okay, well, the next breakthrough runner-up is titled Receptor Visions, and there's a picture here of what looks to be the crystal structure of a protein. Katrina, haven't scientists found the crystal structure of a lot of kinds of proteins?
But we care about the crystal structure of this protein, which is called the G protein coupled adrenergic receptor, for several reasons. First of all, it's a membrane protein, and it's been very, very hard to crystallize. Membrane proteins are not well behaved. They don't line up in nice orderly rows to form crystals, which you need to do to really figure out their structure. And so technically, this was a challenge. The scientists that made this crystal stabilized this protein by hooking an antibody or another smaller protein to a particularly flexible and troublesome loop. And by doing that, they got the protein to behave and line up in an orderly crystal, and were able to get data that allowed reconstruction of the atomic structure of this fairly large protein.
You take a bunch of party streamers after New Year's, and you wad them all up together when you're going to throw them out. They look like that. They're really complicated.
The other reason we're so excited about this is that this is only the second member of this class to be crystallized, and this class is a very important class. It has an unwieldy name, G-protein-coupled receptors, but in fact there are thousands of these types of receptors on all of your cells. They receive signals from hormones, from neurotransmitters. They even receive the light that comes into your eye. Rhodopsin, our light receptor, light photoreceptor, is a G-protein coupled receptor. So they're very, very important molecules. They're evolutionarily very active, and so it's important to understand them from a lot of people's point of view.
Presumably, including the drug companies.
The sort of receptor that it is the kind of receptor that about 50% of all drugs target. And so far, researchers have done a really good job of developing drugs without knowing the structure of any of these receptors. They have other ways of doing it. But they think that if they can find out what these things really look like, these little things that stick through the cell membranes, then they'll be able to do a more effective job because, you know, they'll know what they're dealing with.
Making for better overall drug activation. Is that it?
Hopefully they'll be able to more exactly target the sites on this protein so that the drug would potentially have fewer side effects. It could perhaps work at lower concentrations if it fits the structure of this receptor better and therefore be more effective and safer for patients.
Okay, well, we're down to the last two runners-up and the breakthrough of the year. But again, as Robert said earlier, these aren't ordered. So, Katrina, what did the astrophysics editors think about this next breakthrough, titled Tracing Cosmic Bullets?
The most exciting finding in astrophysics this year, without question.
This one was a really good one. This is one that the Pierre Auger Observatory discovered earlier in this year about ultra-high-energy cosmic rays, which are these particles, mostly protons from outer space, that come screaming into the atmosphere at incredibly high energies. And they've always puzzled scientists for a couple of reasons. One is that nobody can figure out where they get all that energy from. And another one is nobody was really sure how many of them there were, because you had two different detectors, one in Japan, one in Utah, and they disagreed about how many of the super high energy particles there actually were. That matters because physicists think that if these things come from a long way away, they should slow down in transit because they're going to be running into the radiation in space that will rob them of their energy, and they'll slow down. So there should be fewer of them above that threshold.
This is the background radiation that's thought to have come from the Big Bang?
The cosmic microwave background left over from the Big Bang. That's right. And that would interfere with their course and take away their energy. So you had the Japanese who were saying there are lots of these ultra-high energy cosmic rays out there. You had the team in Utah saying, no, not so many. And so this other detector down in Argentina, which is the biggest and best one yet, took a look and they found out, by golly, there is no excess. There is about what you'd expect. So there's really no mystery there if they're right. So they did something else too. Not only did they find out that there's no excess of these really high energy cosmic rays, they also think they might have found out where they're coming from.
And where are they coming from?
The middle of galaxies.
But not the Milky Way?
Not ours, no. These are the middle of galaxies that are called active galactic nuclei that are spewing energy into space. And it turns out that when you look at where these things seem to be coming from, you can match them up pretty well with these active galactic nuclei, all of which are within 250 million light years of Earth. Now, that's pretty close on a cosmic scale because the other edge of the universe, as far away we can see, is 46.5 billion light years away. So these things come from close enough so that their encounters with the cosmic microwave background won't take away all of their energy. So that explains how they can be that energetic, and it may explain where they came from. The one thing it doesn't explain is how anything can accelerate them to that kind of energy in the first place. That's something that the astrophysicists still have to figure out.
A potential breakthrough for the future.
Maybe next year.
Well, to the last of the runners-up and to the breakthrough of the year.
Now come the hard ones.
Why are they hard?
Well, for one thing, they're politically fraught.
Katrina, what did the editors think?
So as soon as we saw that induced stem cells had been reported for humans, we knew it had to be a breakthrough of the year. This finding is important on a lot of levels. Scientifically, it gets us further along the road to making tailor-made cells for replacing diseased or injured human cells than anything else that's happened before. The hope of stem cells in general is to be able to coax a stem cell, which can, in theory, make any other cell in the body, to coax it to become a heart cell, a muscle cell, a liver cell, whatever a particular patient might need, and then be used for repair or treatment of a diseased or damaged organ. And the reason this is better than the existing transplant technology is because these cells can be engineered to be genetically identical to the patient and therefore not susceptible to rejection by the patient's immune system. They're a much better solution to the problem of diseased organs.
Getting back to something you said earlier, Robert, why is this politically fraught?
The real importance of using these non-embryonic stem cells is that you don't have to take them from embryos. And that avoids a lot of political sensitivities, and all the wrangling over experiments on embryos would just go away.
But nobody has been able to get human embryonic stem cells from a patient, right?
No, not yet. And most researchers are saying that there's still a lot of research to be done in that area, too.
All right. Well, we've talked about all the runners-up to the breakthrough of the year. So now it's time to talk about the breakthrough of the year itself.
The breakthrough of the year, human genetic variation, is a really complicated story to tell, so I'm just going to focus on one aspect of it. It's the aspect that really excited me. So this year, there was a major shift in thinking about exactly what is different from one human being to another. We're used to thinking about genetic diseases being caused by tiny but critical changes in DNA sequences. Everybody knows the story about a single nucleotide change causing sickle cell anemia. It changes the function of a particular protein, and that causes the disease state. And then when we started knowing more about the human genome after we first cloned it, we started learning that there were these variations called SNPs, single nucleotide polymorphisms, where one person's genome might differ at one nucleotide from another person's genome, and that those were important. We learned that there are probably about 15 million of these, and that that variation was a significant amount of variation from human to human. And in fact, that's been the basis of some important analyses of human diseases this year. But that's only part of the story. This year, we realized that people can actually have different numbers of the same genes, that they can have multiple regulatory regions of a particular gene, while somebody else can just have one regulatory region of that gene. And they both can still be perfectly healthy.
Meaning that a person's genome might be larger than somebody else's?
That's right. It can exceed the size by millions of bases because they might have more duplicated genes than another person.
So the genome is 3.1 billion bases, give or take.
Right. Some people can actually be missing entire pieces of DNA. Or a piece of DNA that might be front to back in one person might be back to front in another person. So when you think about all these different kinds of changes, you realize that we now have a new view of how the human genome can vary from one person to another. This gives evolution a lot more material to work on. It might be advantageous to have more regulatory regions under some circumstances for a particular gene. It might be more advantageous in another environment to have fewer regulatory regions. And that could be an adaptive evolutionary process going on. So this really changes our way of thinking not only about what might be the cause of human disease, but how evolution acts on the human genome to make us who we are.
Was there a particular paper that came out in this breakthrough, or was this just a combination of lots of work going on around the world?
There was one paper that first reported the extent of this copy number variation. And so that was really a critical finding. And then there have been many other papers that have looked at some of these other aspects of genome variation.
So human genetic variation is the breakthrough of the year because, Robert?
The breakthrough is the realization that human genomes vary a lot from individual to individual and how this can be used to help make our lives better by treating genetic diseases. But like most of our breakthroughs, this is a pure research breakthrough, and the practical applications may be a while in coming.
All right. Well, thank you both very much.
My pleasure.
Thank you, Robert. I've enjoyed it.
That was Science's deputy editors Katrina Kellner and Robert Kuntz talking about 2007's breakthroughs of the year. For more on the year's breakthroughs, including articles from the special section and a video about human genetic variation, please visit www.sciencemag.org/SCIEXT/BTOY2007. Well, now joining me is David Grimm, editor of Science's free online daily news site, Science Now. Hi, David.
Hey, Rob.
David, I understand you've got a selection of the top 10 Science Now stories from 2007.
Right. For the first time this year, we're actually compiled a list of our favorite stories from the year, and I'll be sharing with you today five selections from that list.
So where do we begin?
Rob, we begin by me asking you, what did the oceanographer say to the astronaut?
Houston, we have a problem?
Pretty close. This is one of our favorite stories from the year, and it's about the first phone call placed from deep sea to space. Specifically, researchers hooked things up so that a researcher in the Alvin submersible, which is about 2.5 kilometers below the East Pacific, was able to make a phone call to another researcher on the International Space Station for a total distance of 253 kilometers, straight up.
Was it a cable then that went from Alvin up to a support ship and then transmitted it to the space station?
Yeah, making the phone call was actually pretty complex. It was one of the hardest parts of the process. The researcher on Alvin had to communicate with its surface ship, Atlantis, via acoustic transponders. And then Atlantis connected to a satellite phone, which was able to call the NASA Johnson Space Center in Houston. And finally, the Space Center was able to dial in the International Space Station. So a few steps wasn't the best connection in the world, but the researchers were actually able to have a decent conversation. And the interesting thing about the story is astrobiologists, of all people, were really excited about this because they say what's fascinating about the story is that the researchers communicated through three different media, water, air, and a vacuum. And that's important because when we're trying to further our space exploration, we'll probably be communicating through a variety of different media. And this shows that it's possible.
That's out of this world, babe. So that story was from January.
Right. And we also had another fun story from January. And this was about dogs being able to picture their owners' faces in their minds. What the researchers did here was they took 28 pooches and they put them in front of a video monitor that was covered by a screen. And then they played them audio of either a stranger calling their name or their owner calling their name. And then they removed the screen. And sometimes they removed the screen and the owner's face was there. And if the dog had heard the owner's voice, then that made perfect sense to the dog. Hey, you know, I was thinking about my owner and there's my owner. But if the screen was removed and the stranger's face was there, but the recording the dog heard was of their owner, then the dog spent a couple extra seconds looking at the screen as if they were confused, going, hey, wait, I was thinking about my owner, but this guy doesn't look like my owner.
Now, what about the reverse case when it was a stranger's voice and the owner's face?
Same situation. The dogs were also confused. So it's a bit of a simplistic experiment, but it does indicate that dogs are actually thinking about you when you call their name. They're actually picturing your face in their head.
So Fido or Fluffy is maybe thinking about more than just his next treat.
When you call his name, exactly.
All right, what's next?
Next is another animal study, this one from March, and this was one of my favorites from the year.
You've got a soft spot for animals, I think.
I do. And actually, a lot of our top 10 stories are actually turned out to be animal stories. They're just popular with us, and they're very popular with our readers. And here's another one, this one concerning rats this time. And the take-home point from this study is that rats are smart enough to know how stupid they are.
You're kidding.
No, and that's why I found this study really fascinating. It's about something called metacognition, which is basically knowing the limits of your own knowledge. Not speaking from personal experience, but when one of us sits down to take a test, for example, and just knows that we're going to bomb it. This is a behavior that was thought to be unique only to advanced animals like primates, and it's even been seen in dolphins. But researchers weren't really sure whether less sophisticated animals actually also possess this ability to know what the limits of their own knowledge were.
So how does a rat bomb a test?
Great question. And another fun part about the study is the test they gave the rats. What they did was they trained the rats to distinguish between long and short bursts of static, maybe a 2-second burst of static versus an 8-second burst of static. And if the rats could tell the difference, they got a treat. But the researchers added a twist, which was that the rats could opt out of the test anytime they wanted. And if they opt out, they still got a little bit of a reward, but not as much as they would get if they got the answer right. So when the test was easy, when the rats only had to distinguish between 2 and 8 seconds of static, most of them said, hey, I can ace this thing. They almost always took the test and got the higher reward. But then the researchers made things harder.
With bursts of static that were harder to distinguish from one another?
Exactly. Instead of having to distinguish between a 2-second burst and an 8-second burst of static, all of a sudden the researchers confronted the rats with distinguishing maybe between a 4-second burst and a 6-second burst. And all of a sudden, a lot more rats start dropping out of the test and choosing the easy reward rather than taking a test that they somehow knew they weren't going to pass. So like I said at the beginning, even though we don't give rats a whole lot of credit, this test really shows that at least they're smart enough to know how stupid they really are.
Okay, so this next story I see is about the human animal. Another favorite of the readers?
Well, definitely human psychology and human social interactions always tend to be favorite stories, and this story is no exception. And this has to do with a popular myth, and some would say popular misconception, that women talk a lot more than men do.
Well, I don't know, Dave. You and I do a lot of talking.
That is true. But a lot of people believe that women talk a lot more than men. In fact, some questionable statistics have said that women use about 20,000 words a day, while men only use about 7,000. And a team of researchers wanted to see, is there really anything to this? So what they did was they took about 400 college students, half women and half men, and they fitted them with voice recorders that would automatically turn on and start recording at random times during the day. And they did this over a few-day period. And at the end of the experiment, they collected all the recorders, counted up all the words that were being used. And what they found is that both men and women use about the same number of words a day, about 16,000 words a day. So men, don't let the women in your life tell you you're not talking enough. And women, don't let those men tell you you're talking too much.
Well, from a story about human interaction to a story about human television interaction. What's this last one you've got for us?
This last story is one of our more controversial stories of the year, and it has to do with videos ostensibly designed to make your baby smarter. And these are educational videos that a parent will pop into the TV and sit their baby or toddler in front of it. And these videos purport to be teaching children vocabulary and improving their cognition. But a team of researchers wanted to say, hey, is there really anything to these claims? Because these companies make these claims, but they really haven't been backed up by any studies. So they conducted a survey of about 1,000 U.S. children and had the parents record how frequently the children were watching these videos and what their average vocabulary was. And surprisingly, the researchers found that for every hour a day these kids spent watching the video, they understood about 6 to 8 words fewer than children that weren't watching the video. And this translates into about a 17 percentile drop in vocabulary for the kids that were watching the videos.
Compared to those of the same age, presumably, who weren't.
Exactly. So if you take the study at face value, it's saying that these videos designed to make your kids smarter might actually be making them dumber.
So what are you supposed to do instead?
Well, the open question here is why these videos might be having this effect. And the researchers speculate that the kids that aren't watching the videos may be reading or interacting with their parents, other activities that might actually build vocabulary instead of just sitting there and watching TV. And as you might expect, the study was very controversial. And actually, not surprisingly, some of the companies that produced these videos issued very angry statements demanding that the university that actually supported the study remove references to it on its website. And as far as I know, it's still an ongoing battle.
What about an ongoing top 10 list? Where are the other stories?
Well, Rob, you're going to have to go to their website to find those other 5. And what you'll also find there is our top story of the year, which is actually our most read story of all time. So be sure to check out the site.
David Grimm is the editor of Science Now, the free online daily news service of science. You can check out the latest science stories and the top story ever at Science Now at sciencenow.sciencemag.org. Thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you too, Rob, and to all of our listeners.
And that wraps up the December 21st, 2007 Science Podcast. Next week, there will be a special podcast on women in science in the Middle East, hosted by Science Magazine's executive editor, Monica Bradford. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. The show is a production of Science Magazine and of AAAS, the Science Society, with additional financial support from the Golden Fund. The content is provided by the news and editorial staff of Science, and Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, thanks for joining us.